So yeah, thanks for everyone who did come here to join. And this was something Will and I bashed around as a concept. It was almost the idea of just having open meetings. That we have a BC campus funded project called Toward Open Education, and it is the objective is to kind of develop and share resources to help institutions in BC collaborate with each other, specifically with a goal towards fostering open education in their own institution. At least that's how I understand the application. And we thought rather than just having Skype calls between ourselves, that we would occasionally just check in an environment that allowed other people to join us if they wanted to. And we're going to archive these and share them out as podcasts as well. So I think that kind of sums up our so-called thinking around this. Will, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I just want to sort of give a plug or a shout out. One of the ideas that this came from was Mozilla's Open Chat. So Mozilla Open Badging has basically a open call semi-regularly, I think weekly or monthly, where anybody can join the conversation and add things to the agenda. So it's nice to, it's a very informal, relaxed way of sort of connecting with people on the same topic. And you know, I think having that sort of conversation and the connectedness to people working in the same area here in BC would be great.
Great. So since we do actually have a rather full agenda for our first chat, I'm going to jump right into it. And so we kind of have three people that we asked to join the call and talk, but I wanted to be clear too that everyone who joins the call can jump in with a question anytime they want. And people shouldn't feel like, well, this is my slot, somebody else's slot. This really is, just think of this as an open chat. But to give it some semblance of structure, I wanted to bring in a couple guys who kind of been the drivers of a project that I think is one of the really fun things happening at Thompson Rivers University right now. And later on, we're going to have Clint Lalonde speak up too about, just give us an update on open textbooks. But first, our MOOC. Which you can find at rmooc.ca. And this was the, I guess the work, the, although it's a collaborative thing, of one of our guests, Ashok Mathur, who is a Canada Research Chair here at TRU. And relatively early on in my, actually even before I started at TRU, I was connected with Ashok and we chatted a little bit. And right away, I felt like this was a person I was hoping I would get the chance to work with. And I was really pleased when Ashok approached me with this idea he had. And with that, Ashok Mathur, could you describe what your ambition was for RMOOC as you kind of entered into the project, or what your broad goals were?
Sure. Sure. First of all, this is a great forum. I'm glad we have this. And shout out back to Brian for helping to stimulate this, the RMOOC, and get it going, and particularly to Alan. And it was, you know, when I approached Brian, he said, you know, I've got just the person who can help us with this, and Alan indeed was that person. And it's the first time I'm actually hearing his voice right on here. It's quite funny, because we've been dealing with everything on email, but he's been just a joy to work with him, and diligent, because someone like me who's got some tech skills, but falls down on others, right? To be able to manage this this site and keep it going the way it has, because it's been a very, very busy site. RMOOC came about, as Brian said, we were having this discussion. I've been working with questions of art and reconciliation for a number of years now. I edited a book called Cultivating Canada with the Aboriginal Healing Foundation a few years ago. And from there, doing a lot of work with artists on the subject of reconciliation, particularly because the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had been struck. We have all these national gatherings. Before our formal talk here, we were chatting a bit about Victoria and the regional gathering and the nationals coming up here in Vancouver. And one of the topics that came up in discussions with critics and artists and activists was that in order to really get to the root of some of these histories around residential schools, around the politics of the Indigenous presence and land and all these things, it seemed that policy and critical analysis alone didn't do the trick. And we wanted to look at it through an artist lens. So over the last couple of years, we worked with a number of artists in Kamloops, in Vancouver, Sault Ste. Marie, and then back in Kamloops this past month to kind of incubate these ideas. How do artists deal with some of these complex ideas? So this past month, what we did was we had a residency with 12 artists coming in from all over the country to work in the TRU Arts art studios, the students' art studios, and within my center that I developed there. And as part of this, we wanted it not to be this standard insular residency where you talk to each other and that's it. Right? We wanted to get the word out and talk to people. And that's where our MOOC came in. We wanted to do a kind of MOOC. I say kind of because it really operates more as a learning platform. There was no set agenda. There was no course structure. You know, we didn't have assignments. There's certainly no fee, no credit, you know, that sort of thing. So it's like a kind of a massive blog, but really for a lot of tutorial use. And what I mean by that is when you take a look at the site, you'll see that that there are a lot of avenues for students and for learners to engage with the artistic principles involved. So we have things like performances. Performance art is a very unique form because it often is done for an audience of 2 people or 10 people or whoever's in the room, whoever has to be passing by. Well, by documenting it, we are able to get a much larger critical audience. Places like Halifax or, you know, Northwest Territories, people can check in and see what's going on. And so that was the intent of the ARMA, is to give people access to all the stuff that was going on at the residency, but we're maintaining it for the next month as well, month and a half, so that we can include several events that are happening. Alex Jandier, who's a major figure in Aboriginal art, part of the Aboriginal Group of Seven, is opening his major, first big gallery in Cold Lake. So we're going to go up there and talk to him about that. The TRC gathering, of course, the national gathering is happening here in Vancouver, September 18th and 21st. So that'll be part of our month. And the discussions are starting to build. And after a very busy month of activity and uploads and video and images and such, now there's a lot of critical analysis. People are starting to talk about what they want to do with this site. So looking forward to that. So that's a you know, big house picture of our MOOC, right? I don't know if I have anything more to say on that. Just want to welcome people as they're dropping in. I see new names coming up. We're just talking about this site called rmoc.ca, which was looking at art and reconciliation in a Canadian context and looking how art can work within these principles of reconciliation. So I think I'll stop there and see if there's people want to have questions or do you want to turn it to Alan to talk about the process or whoever else.
I have one question, and certainly if anyone else has, feel free, they can jump in as well. But some of the terminology used to show kind of highlights why I was really excited to have the chance to work with you on this. For example, when you describe the initiative less as a formal course and more of a learning platform, which is a phrase I've heard you use before in your goals for the site, I'm wondering if you could maybe step back a little bit and describe some of the attributes of a learning platform that are important to you for a project like this, or maybe for other projects moving forward, given that most of the people on this call are educational technologists and you're a faculty researcher, teacher, a community networker. I mean, you're so many things, but you know, when you describe things like a learning platform, what are some of the characteristics or attributes that you feel are important?
Okay, it's a good question, Brian. And I want to step back a bit further from that and talk about a pedagogical principle. And I come from a background of liberatory pedagogy, following, you know, thinkers like Paulo Freire and those who were looking at a student-based pedagogy, right? Something the learner can bring into the space, as opposed to a more conventional learning situation, which is often, you know, Freire calls it the banking method, you know, where you have a prof who is presenting material and students receive the material in a passive way and then regurgitate it, you know, for tests and exams, that sort of thing. And so to me, it's a very ineffective form of pedagogy to have the lecture-driven form. And there are many who will disagree because they'll say, well, to get the information out, there's a certain body of information that has to come out. And there is in certain fields and disciplines, but I argue for the type of critical thinking we're trying to perpetuate, it has to be student-driven. So then to ramp it forward to the notion of a learning platform, I wasn't interested in, and I'm not interested in, the idea of testing people's knowledge or having to prove themselves in some way. You know, were you on the site today? What did you learn? Here's the assignment. Here's my grade on your assignment. Right? Move outside of that model to, again, what I call a liberatory pedagogical model, where people are thinking through potentials, and they're just they're bringing all this information in. They may be lurking on this site, not saying a thing, but they're also absorbing so much as they're in that space. So, for as an example, one of the performances done was by Peter Morin, who's a Tahltan artist on the West Coast. And he's been working for a number of years on this notion of hair. He said when the kids went into residential school, one of the first things that happened is their hair was cut. It was culturally very significant, and it represented for many a cutting off from their own cultural backgrounds. So he did this amazing performance. He built a number of drums, and he said he wanted to see what it was like to be the scissors, right? The scissors that cut the hair. So he literally used his face to run through the paper that was on which was drawn all his hair. And as he did this, he was working with two other artists, Cheryl Larando, who's a singer and a songwriter, Métis singer and songwriter, and she was drumming him through this and singing him through this. And at the same time, Ayumi Goto, who's a performer, and she does work on Japanese imperial history as well as indigenous work, was doing this symbolic gesturing of cutting her own hair in front of everyone, washing it, and then giving it over to Peter as a gift to reclaim the notion of hair as a loss. So it was a very, very beautiful, very moving thing. But Brian, you were there, but there's about 20 people who could be there in the space. But by perpetuating this out there, I've been getting all those responses from people who are then able to say, what I learned from this was this, right? So that learning platform idea becomes a space for people it's a conversation starter. So they start to look through it, thinking about what they can make of these particular sites without the imperative of saying, I registered in this course and I'm getting credit for it. And so right from the start, I said to Brian, I want to do this thing, but a bit off the beaten track. I don't want to do it through official means. I don't want it to look like a course where people do have to register. And let's see how it goes this time and then see what we can do in the future. Because I think, there's a lot of talk about MOOCs, a lot of talk about education. And I'm neither a nihilist thinking that these are terrible things, nor am I thinking that, wow, the MOOC is the future for everyone. Right? How can we develop and retain a sense of priorities, learning priorities, when we're building something like this? So I don't know if that answers your question, Brian, but it's a way of developing strategies so people can access information, but then also be purveyors of information. They're not given it, they're just passive receivers.
No, I think it answers it really well. And I think you articulate both in what you're saying and in your specific choice of words, a lot of the characteristics is why I think watching how well you and the community you've been working with have kind of taken to the platform. And I know Alan's made this comment many times, he's really so impressed with how quickly you've picked up on things and found affordances of the environment he set up and taking really great advantage of it. So we might use that as a pivot to shift to Alan. But before I do, I don't want this to feel like too much of a formal presentation. So if there's anyone else on the call that would like to ask Ashok a question or follow up on anything that he said, I'll just pause for a moment to allow that to happen. And if not, we'll move ahead to Alan.
And also just to let people know, and people haven't been on the platform before, if they wanted to throw something onto the chat space or ask me something, just a clarification, whatever, feel free to do that so we can have different ways of discussing things.
Hey, Ashok, it's Clint here. You mentioned one of the sort of affordances of having this open platform, and that was that you were able to sort of document this really powerful experience and then share it out with other people, beyond the 20 people that were there witnessing this in person. Did you find there were other affordances of doing this kind of work in the open? Did you have outside participation from people who are outside the core group that you were with? Did you notice that happening as well?
What happens, we're up to 115 or so people registered in the course. A lot of them are people who have been dealing with things like reconciliation discourses, right? These are academics, or they're activists in various forms, or artists, right? We couldn't do that. So that's what we saw. The one thing I think I'm anticipating it to change now, but there was a lack of desire or impetus or something for people to be putting things up on their own. They would with some encouragement. So we had one postdoc who's here in David Gardner's here in Vancouver at UBC, and he was posting some of his papers and presentations. That was really good to see. But for the most part, what I was getting was a lot of offline stuff. People saying, "Ah, oh, I saw this video, man. I don't know what to say, but it's great." But that included even the artists who were there, who were trying to say something about your work, and they didn't get around to that. They were just saying, "Let the site speak for itself." So it's hard to gauge. You know, you're only really a month and a half into it. I don't know, it's over a month. So I don't know what to, you know, I'd be curious to hear from Brian and Alan too about where they think this will go, because the danger of a site like this too is that it simply becomes a very kind of interactive website where you have a lot of stuff up there, people get to see it, right? And that goes directly against what I was saying before, which is, you know, people have some sort of agency in there. So that's what I'm concerned with. But yeah, there were a lot of people from across the country who were engaged in it. And from what I've been hearing, people are quite excited just to go on there and check it out once or twice a week or whatever, see what's new. And of course, many of them know these artists and they know their works. They wanted to see, well, what is Adrian Stimson doing as Buffalo Boys, one of his personas he has. And they get to see this because they're not at the opening and they get to participate in that one.
Great, thanks. Maybe we'll take that opportunity to lure Alan out of silence. And thank you for your question, Clint. That was a good one. Alan, you know, as Ashok mentioned, when Ashok kind of talked about generally, you know, the kind of things he wanted the learning platform to have, you know, I thought of you right away, in part because I knew you'd done some, you know, amazing work with the S106 and other little things like that. I thought, could you maybe just as an opening point, feel free to diverge off this question any way you want, but, you know, really I just would like to hear a little bit of your thought process, which I know you've documented in insane detail on your blog, and I'm going to post that link in a moment on the site, but just some of the broad thinking as you started to kind of pull the RMOOC site together and the kind of things you were trying to do.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And I also want to say, it was some irony that Ashok and I have never spoken before, and we had the space to do it. So all our communications in by email. And I just want to thank him again for bringing me in on part of this project. For many reasons, for some of the technical things I got to try out and implement, but also because of the powerful media that I was seeing come into the site. And so a big piece when Brian and Ashok approached me was using this syndication approach, which I've been a part of and using and building with the digital storytelling class, DS106, Alec Kouros's EtMOOC project last year. Got me a chance to try that for a different approach. And the whole principle is that creating a site that allows people to contribute to it through many distributed means, as simple as tagging photos in Flickr, tweeting with a hashtag, with the idea of bringing it together in a site like RMOOC, where we've got that content coming in from the community that can also mingle with the content that Ashok or the content providers can create for themselves. So the platform concept is very kind of loose, because it means that unlike a lot of the MOOC platforms where everything is contained within that box of the site, it's pretty open. So we've got things going on up in Kamloops with these activities that we're not part of, but the syndicated media allows us to be not like we're there, but to at least appreciate what's going on and possibly to react to it. And so I was really excited about the project because this one as I understood it, was going to be driven a lot by media. So that kind of drove some of the design decisions and the sort of ways we wanted people to participate. And so the things that we built in to bring into the site, Twitter, which is pretty easy to use, so syndicating by a hashtag, and that saw a fair amount of traffic. Twitter's good for having that conversational flow and pointing to other content and getting a little bit of the conversational aspect. We did set up blog syndication, although I don't think that was part of the first phase of the residency, obviously because people were there. But in the future, and maybe with what Ashok's going to do next, he might have students or people publishing stuff from their own sites that can be pulled into our MOOC, or even from other sites that may be regularly publishing content that's relevant, so sort of as an aggregation of content. The visual, we did Flickr. We had some really interesting challenges. I don't know why, but Ashok's Flickr account, for some reason, would never aggregate photos, and it was very aggravating. And like many things, we had to sometimes find some end-arounds and ultimately get that to work. I did set up Instagram, which is actually pretty easy to syndicate in. They've got good RSS feeds, although that wasn't really used, but it's there as a potential. The thing that I've been using on two recent projects that I really like that sound kind of low-tech and aren't really syndication is email. So our MOOC runs on WordPress, blogging platform, and the Jetpack plugin that you can install for free has this ability to create a single email address, and people can contribute directly to the blog just by writing an email. So I really like that approach because that's about the easiest thing that people can do to create. So the subject line becomes the title. Whatever they put in the body of the message and the format and the links becomes the post. And if you attach images, sound files, video to a certain file size, that gets attached to the post. So you can write to this blog directly from any email browser or a mobile phone. So we called those dispatches. So it's not pure syndication in a way, but it was an interesting way to get information to the site. And then the other element, which I hadn't done before, was we knew that we wanted to be able to publish information about our MOOC through email announcements. And we used MailChimp, which is a free for relatively low volume email service for sending out emails in a way that people can subscribe themselves, they can unsubscribe, and a lot of variety in the ways that you can format the emails. And it just kind of, I mean, looks aren't everything, but it comes across more professional than just an email sent from Ashok's personal email account. And you get a little bit of tracking, so you know how many people are on your list and how many of them are reading your emails. So I was really pleased with the way we're able to use MailChimp. And some of the best parts about working with Ashok was a lot of things, like I told him where to put things, he was off and running. So the site was changing almost on a daily basis. The front end with the big flashing banner is a nice way to organize things. I see it on a lot of websites, but all he had to do was to check a box on a post that we called featured, and the five most recent items got pushed to that banner area in the front. And there's another area we call spotlights. So as Ashok is sort of looking at the site and seeing pictures or tweets that other people are contributing, you can go in quickly and just add a little category to that, and you're able to pull out content from the flow of syndication that you may want to foreshadow. So that's a little bit of the overall bits of the way the site was put together. Like Brian says, that long blog post is sort of my own note taking and has a lot of bits of code and ugly bits of technical talk, but hopefully it might be useful to someone else.
I want to just ask you kind of a broad question based on that, on that post you wrote, because I kind of had I don't think I've ever encountered anybody who is so, and I pardon the pun, dogged about kind of documenting and reflecting on work you've done. You very rarely let these things pass, and this might be one of the more detailed examples of it. And we talk a lot about reflective process or reflecting on our process or sharing process. You really practice it. And I don't know if you have anything you want to share just on the importance of that to you. Like you're obviously getting some kind of motivation out of that beyond, you know.
A little bit of OCD, maybe. A lot of it is for my own reference because I will forget. Like, as always, when you're in the middle of a project, it's like there at the front of your brain. And then 6 months later, it becomes a dim memory. So for me, it's somewhat note-taking. But I think you're right in the writing about it. And that post took about 6 hours. And it's like, I could have, you know, been 6 hours working on something else. But it becomes part of my process again for kind of just going through my own thinking and how that was put together. And it helps kind of solidify it a little bit in my mind. So the reflective part of writing is something that I've really tried to push when I teach the digital storytelling course, because a lot of times people think of the blog or their web space as, oh, this is the place where I just dump my video that I created. Here it is. Here's my assignment, and I'm done. And really what I try to have my students do is not just create things, but talk about where the ideas came from and how they developed and what went wrong. You know, when we were in this process of running the site, somewhere, and we still haven't figured it out, someone got access to the site or hacked it and deleted some content, but we're able to restore it. And then there was an outage for about 5 days where our web hosting, which I had told them is rock solid, it's been up 99.9% since February, went south because of some hardware failures, a hard disk failure. And so, you know, the great thing about this is, like, you don't fold the tent and go home. You don't pull a Georgia Tech and say, oh, we screwed up on that MOOC and we can't let all these people use Google. You figure out how to get around it and how to fix it. So that's part of the process of running these sites is they're going to falter. They're going to have malfunctions. And, you know, you have to, like, not realize it's the end of the world. It's important, and it does cause me heartache when the site doesn't work. But, you know, you motor through it.
I just want to come back to what Brian was highlighting too, is your posts are such great resources. I know it's something that we always wish we could do better on our end, is document the stuff we're working on. But oftentimes when we're Googling, trying to figure out how to do something, we come across a post that you've written and we kind of take your lead on it a lot.
Well, thanks. And honestly, it's kind of the in terms of, like, openness, I find this stuff all the time, and like, I'm finding more and more with WordPress. I'm getting stuff from Stack Exchange. I get more answers to my WordPress issues than the WordPress Codex, which is kind of their community. And so most of the things I've built are not anything I've done from scratch. I find bits of code or ways other people have done things, and then I try to figure them out. So to me, it's just part of that process of the web gives to me, and I feel like I should give back.
I'd just like to add something too. What Mel was saying before about kind of the fluidity and flexibility, and that's something that's really important, because it is easy and very tempting, especially on tech stuff, to say this isn't working, and that's the end of the world, right? But when you realize that there's activity happening outside of that, and a lot of connections that are going on, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, I get a few notes from people saying, "Oh, I tried to get on the site, it was down." And you know, we'd work on a fix. My working on a fix was saying, "Hey, Alan, what do I do?" Right? But the thing is, it's these are very effective ways and fluid ways, and it works in a nicely charged way, because you try and get to stuff going and get stuff working, but you don't think if it's not working in 10 minutes, then, you know, that's it, because it's not the central thing. The ideas are the central thing. And so that's why it was great working with Alan, just because we could do the stuff and make it happen.
Very cool. I'd invite anyone else to jump in at this point before we maybe shift gears and formally bring Clint back into the conversation in this informal chat. But before that, I just, Alan, I saw on your blog today, and Will mentioned this too when we checked in before logging on, your latest bit of kind of experimental coolness in open instruction, this this essentially one of the cool things about the digital storytelling DS-106 environment is the assignment submission process allows students to submit assignments. And it looks like, if I'm understanding the blog correctly, is you essentially created a framework for this that'll work for other courses. Do I have that?
I'm starting to do that. It's something a little bit of support came through to be able to pay me a little money to work on this. But it's been something I've wanted to do for a while, is that people love the assignment bank that we use for DS-106, which was an idea to say, rather than when you're teaching a course, to always have, like, in week five, everybody has to do this kind of video. So we have categories of assignments, and instead we can say, okay, in week five, we're doing video. You get to choose to do 15 stars worth, which is kind of the difficulty rating of assignments. And then people can choose the things they want to do rather than us prescribing it. So, you know, assignment banks and test banks and OERs have been around for quite some time. And the beauty of this is that people in the DS-106 community contribute to it. And since working on the DS-106 version, which was originally done brilliantly by Martha Burtis at UMW, like stitching together a Google form and some syndication, I don't even know how it worked, to a more semi-robust way, is that it's very specific. Like, there's things in the WordPress site that are coded specifically to DS-106. And if I gave you that, you know, our files for that, you wouldn't know what to do with it. And I wouldn't know what to do with it if I hadn't been familiar with it. So the idea that I've been thinking for a while is that I was pretty sure it could be built as a WordPress theme. So if you want to set up a site that is a bank of anything, not just assignments, you would install this theme. You'd have some configurations like themes where you get to pick the colors and the header size and the sidebars. You'd be able to say, what do I want to call my things? Maybe they're assignments, maybe they're challenges, and pick icons to represent them and categories, and essentially be able to run your own version of that with your own content and sort of subject area. So I'm on my way. It's still it's harder to build something that's generalizable for other people to use than just to get in there and have the code to get it to work. But I'm hopeful by the end of the month I'll at least have like a beta version that some people can test out. And there's some, I'm trying to optimize some of the code. You know, there's a lot of spaghetti code from the, because it's been worked on by a number of people over the years. And to get it, I'm using a variation of one of the Bootstrap themes, so it'd be pretty flexible, responsive on multiple devices and that sort of thing. But also flexible for the ways that people are going to want to customize it, not only for content, but for design.
I'm really excited to be seeing that. Clint mentioned in the text, you know, what a resource, just even as a dare I say, repository of learning materials that the assignment bank has turned into. And just last week, we had a workshop on audio production here at TRU, and we ended up using multiple assignments from the assignment bag as challenges for people to do, and they all worked really, really well. And I think they were contributed by four or five different people, none of whom I think were formal instructors of DS-106. So it's a cool model, and it's neat to see this is spinning out now as a technology framework, not just as a content resource.
There's kind of grand dreams. You know, I'd like to do the same thing with the Daily Create and something of the aggregation hub, leveraging some of the stuff Martin Hawksey's done to sort of build a web-based RSS reader for the aggregation hub. I'm really interested in working on something like that.
Yeah, I'm tempted to go real deep on syndication here. it's one of those kind of rabbit holes you can go kind of, you know, really deep into. But maybe before we shift gears, I might just ask you, I mean, you know, on some level, you know, if you just read TechCrunch or something, or if Robert Scoble is your idea of, you know, the epitome of a tech guru, you'd think that these are really dark times for syndication. More and more platforms are not supporting RSS publication. You know, of course, Google Reader shut down its service. And so in some ways, you know, syndication is kind of an old idea that, you know, maybe its time never came. But, you know, something like our MOOC or just, you know, so much of the work you're doing in general really rests on syndication. So, I mean, sometimes when I talk about this stuff with people, people might come back like, well, why would we do this? Like, why not just have an integrated environment? Does it just come down to ownership? Does it just say that this is a way for people to have their own space as an owner? Or is there something more to it, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think a lot of that talk is kind of mistaking the concept of syndication for the technology of RSS. So even as RSS may sort of not be used as much in some places, there's still syndication going on through JSON and other and API technologies. So I think there's a lot of facets of the syndication concept that I would like to maybe push out some understanding so that people are thinking it more of just it's the distributed way of publishing that is the internet. And to me, the whole beauty of what I've been able to work on these last couple of years with DS106 and some of these other projects is that it's how the internet works. I mean, it's this distributed node of people publishing and connecting to each other. It's not like AOL was trying to be in you know, in the late 80s, you know, to put it all inside one box. So to me, the syndication technologies are changing, perhaps not. I mean, RSS still works, but I think it's more of the understanding of this concept of how we don't have to have everything published or contained inside one giant enterprise. We can have these parts that are distributed, which brings on its own issues of perhaps chaos and disorder, but there's also a lot more, to me, potential for creativity and imagination in that. And I can even go more Carl Sagan on you, and that's like how the universe is constructed, but I think I'll stop.
Yeah, but the point you make, though, about the confusion and the distributed you know, piece, that's where syndication to me actually is really necessary to pull all of these distributed pieces together to have that kind of cohesion. When you're talking in a teaching and learning in context, I think you need to have that central piece. And what I really like about the things like RMOOC and these things is you're allowed to have a distributed presence on all of these different types of platforms. So you're going to find bits and pieces on YouTube. You're going to find some pieces on Flickr. And all of these bits and pieces that you find can be found independent of the RMOOC site and can act as a touchstone for people to interact with the content by leaving a comment on the YouTube video. So they don't even have to know that RMOOC is there. They can actually find this resource, and if they choose to interact with it on YouTube or Flickr or, you know, jump in on Twitter, it's there for them to be able to do that. So.
And just to sort of follow up, I think Clint said it really, really well right there, but I'm also just seeing a lot of excitement from instructors who have been working in sort of an open area where they've been putting their content openly and now are seeing syndication as a real exciting way to have people come in and participate with the open resources that they've created. So participating in their own sites, but then feeding them into their main site as well. So they just see it as, okay, I'm taking one step beyond just creating an open online presence. I'm now inviting people to come into that presence as well.
Yeah, and the hurdle is it's still kind of rad. I mean, syndication, it sounds like a technical thing, you know, and then all of a sudden you're talking RSS and that XML and the eyes are getting glazed over.
So I'm just going to hold off again just a second, maybe before we kind of semi-formally shift gears to invite Clint to give us an update on open textbooks. But just since I can often be a little quick on the trigger on this, I'll just take a quick breath here. And if anybody else wants to jump in with any final questions or comments for Alan or Ashok or on the concepts we've been talking about, feel free.
You are the cordial host, Brian, you know.
Nothing if not cordial. All right, well, I'm hearing dead air. So Clint, thank you so much for joining us. given that, you know, I think one of the things that I think Will and I are hoping to do with this, with these chats is to just find a, you know, be one of many mechanisms that we use to kind of keep in touch with what everyone's doing. And, you know, certainly from a formal point of view, probably the biggest open initiative in British Columbia right now, obviously, is the Open Textbook Project. And obviously, BC Campus is taking the lead role on that. And so just I thought for anybody who might be curious about, as summer of 2013 comes to a close, where the Open Textbook Project stands and where the next steps might be. Clint, is that open-ended enough for you?
That is great, yeah. Thanks, and thanks for letting us pop in here and take part, because I'm very interested in participating in this community and seeing this community kind of thrive and do well. And Alan, I just have to say too that I really appreciate the fact that you do blog in such detail, because I've learned so much from you and so much from your blog by the, you know, the fact that you're writing this and putting it out there in the open. So thank you. So I think everybody here is pretty familiar with the Open Textbook Project that's happening here in British Columbia. I'm given some seed money from the Ministry of Advanced Education to promote the adoption, adaptation, and the creation of open textbooks, 40 open textbooks to be specific, for highly enrolled subjects here in British Columbia. So the project was announced last year at OpenEd, and we've had a busy summer, so I'll just give you a quick little update here on what we're working on and what we're looking to do for this fall. So over the summer, we identified a number of current open textbooks. A big piece of the project is we don't want to build open textbooks from scratch. We would like to try to leverage what's out there in the commons and be able to see what others have done, because there's some fantastic projects that are happening in the open textbook space. And I'm thinking specifically of projects like the OpenStax College project out of Connections and Rice University. So we've been in touch with those types of projects and searching commons to find existing open textbooks that will match up with the top 40 subjects. So we set up a site, a WordPress site, everybody I'm sure is familiar with, open.bccampus.ca, where we have put up a number of textbooks. I think we're at 20 right now. And over the summer, we have been asking faculty to review those textbooks. So we had a call for proposals looking for faculty in the spring. We had about 60 faculty representing just over 20 institutions in the province taking part to review these open textbooks. And as part of the review process, the reviews are posted along with the textbook on the open.bccampus.ca website. We think this is actually a pretty important piece for adoption of the open textbooks. With open educational resources, there's often questions from faculty about the quality of them and how do they know that they are quote-unquote good resources. So one of the strategies that we had was to try to be visible with the review process and post those reviews on the website so other faculty could take a look at them and say, you know, this person found it a useful resource, or this person, you know, didn't, or almost there and needs some work. So we've been collecting these over the summer. The deadline for the reviews is September the 3rd. So I just sent out a notice to the faculty who have not yet submitted a review this morning, telling them that the deadline is coming up on September 3rd. But I think we've got close to 20 reviews up for some of the textbooks that we have on that site. So that's been the big project that we had as part of the project, is getting these reviews up and posted on the site. We've also been searching out extra additional textbooks, so we have another stack of textbooks that we're going to be adding to the site in the next few weeks, existing textbooks that we found. And we've been talking about doing a second round of reviews for new textbooks that we add to the collection. So that may be coming up this fall. We have also been working on a print-on-demand solution. So we had a call for proposals out looking for partners to help us do print-on-demand, recognizing that students will still want physical copies of these textbooks. And we have the call for proposals for that closes today, actually. So hopefully we'll be able to announce a partner for the print-on-demand piece of the Open Textbook project here in the next few weeks. And we've also been doing some work with Pressbooks. Pressbooks is the platform that we're hoping to use for remixing some content. And if we do create new textbooks out of this project, to be able to do that on the Pressbooks platform. It's a WordPress plugin. And we've been contributing some modifications to that plugin. We had two modifications. Our developer, Brad Payne, has been working this summer with the Pressbooks team and has had two modifications to the plugin or extensions of the plugin accepted into core. And those are importers, so we can now import EPUB documents directly into Pressbooks, and they will come out into the Pressbooks blog, the WordPress blog. And we also have an open document type importer, so we can take documents from ODT and import those in as well. And we see those as being important pieces for being able to remix existing content. And so we're working on a couple of more importers right now. So we're looking at doing a Word importer based on that ODT importer and a LaTeX importer, which could be a bit of a challenge. And for those of you who are not familiar with LaTeX, it is a document markup language that's used mostly in the sciences and math to mark up scientific notations, which is particularly challenging on the web. So those are the three pieces that we've been working on this summer. This fall, we are looking at trying to, again, promote adoptions. We've had some adoptions that we've heard of, mostly of those OpenStax textbooks. We know of four here in the province, UBC, Douglas, Kwantlen, and I believe it's Langara might be the fourth institution that will be using textbooks from OpenStax this fall. So unfortunately, the project didn't really get up to steam in time, I think, to get a great deal of adoption for this fall. By the time we were going and running, most faculty had already picked their resources and their textbooks that they were going to use this fall. So we're going to put on a bit more of a push this fall for adoption. And start talking and looking closely at the reviews that we've gotten of the existing resources that we have and find out what textbooks we have in there that just need a little bit of modification to really make them stellar textbooks in the eyes of the faculty that are using these textbooks and be able to do some remix projects this fall to test out some of the technology pieces that we're putting into place. Mary's also here too. I don't know, Mary, have I covered kind of the high points? Do you have anything else you want to add to this?
No, I think you did a great job. Thanks for that, Clint. I guess just maybe for people's interest sake, sort of the next stage of what we're doing will be the call for adaptations, which will come out next month. And also, we've been working with the ministry on, I don't know if anybody is aware, but they did commit to another 20 textbooks as an election promise. And so we've been advocating for what we think those should be. We don't have confirmation of that yet, but we're hoping to do some textbook zero programs and veer a little bit away from the high enrollment courses and into some of the what we would consider to be high impact areas, trades, technology, tourism, ABE, for example. And so so we're working on those pieces as well as beginning to work on sort of sustainability plans for how the project will long-term sustain the resources or how the resources will be sustained, whether or not it is part of the project or not. But yeah, otherwise, any questions, happy to answer. But yeah, great job, Clint. That's, I think, represents well sort of what we've had our heads down on for the last several months.
That sounds fantastic, and thank you for mentioning the orientation potentially for those next 20 textbooks. You actually anticipate a question I had, which was, you know, obviously given some of the unique needs within the province, whether there'd be any emphasis on, you know, some of the subject matter here that may not be highest enrollment in a general sense, but, you know, may have very specific applications here in the province. But it sounds like that's certainly part of your thinking, probably no doubt because of feedback you've been getting around the province.
Absolutely, that's a huge part of it. And I would say the ministry obviously is really interested in areas where there are skills gaps. So I think I'm feeling pretty positive that they're hearing what we're saying about that and wanting to meet those needs, and particularly the needs in some of the institutions that don't offer necessarily those high enrollment courses. So we're very hopeful, and I'm feeling quite positive that that's the direction we'll move in next. Of course, we've got to get to the 41st, but yeah, and it's also, I think, a really good sign that they are committed to another 20 and that they are seeing more and more value in open. And so, yeah, sort of in the longer term, I'm feeling really positive about the relationship that the ministry is having to openness and their advocacy work really at a national level as well. So yeah, it's good stuff.
Before we kind of go into the kind of quick round of updates from anybody here on the call about anything open related that might be happening at their institution or things they're thinking about, I just want to fire one more question at Clint. Just a bit more about Pressbooks, if you could talk about it from almost like a web administrator or manager perspective. I gather you're actually working with the tool and you got your arms, you got your sleeves rolled up a little bit. It's a tool we're looking at TRU here for a couple of publications that have kind of been in PDF form and floating around from a couple of researchers here at TRU and looking for ways to kind of enhance the accessibility of those books. So I just, you know, from the point of view of an individual institution that's looking at something like Pressbooks, based on your experience so far, is there any quick hits, Clint, on viability, usability, approaches to using it, things to avoid?
Yeah, there are some things about the platform that one thing we're noticing is even though it is open source and even though there's a plugin, there are developers that are starting to develop with it. When you actually first install Pressbooks, they're hooked pretty deeply into Pressbooks.com, their own website. So when you do, everything is sort of pushing people in the Pressbooks world on the, even though we have a self-hosted instance, is pushing people back to Pressbooks.com. So we're trying to figure out a way to kind of cleanly, I mean, we certainly want to give Pressbooks credit, but we don't necessarily want to have links back to makeabook@pressbooks.com on all of the content that we create. So that's, and that stuff is pretty heavily coded. When this is the new project that we have right now, so it's kind of top of mind right now. So there are some theme adjustments that need to be done. Theming is not super easy as well. They've done a lot of customization with the theming, so if you want to create sort of a custom theme for a book, that can be a bit of a challenge. What it does really nicely is it gives you this great, mobile version of a website that's optimized and works really well on mobile devices. So I've tried it out on numerous devices just out of the box, and it works really well. So for for a project that wants to be very mobile aware for students, that is very attractive. It's also a nice clean user interface. But if you are used to using WordPress and you install Pressbooks, you're going to notice that they've completely changed the administrative console and have created a whole bunch of custom post types. So it can be a little bit disorienting if you're used to working in Pressbooks when you first go into or WordPress if you first go into a Pressbooks site, because it is a little bit of a different layout. However, that said, once if you are familiar with WordPress, it shouldn't pose much of a challenge other than that initial, whoa, this is not what I'm kind of used to. And the other thing that Jason mentioned here in the chat is the PDF rendering does require a commercial PDF rendering engine. And I know at the beginning of the project, the developers of Pressbooks tried out a whole bunch of different open source PDF rendering engines and found one that or couldn't find an open source one that worked, that did a really clean PDF rendering that they wanted to use. So they've concentrated on using this commercial product called Prince. So if you are looking at hosting a Pressbooks instance and want to do PDF outputs, you would need to expend a little bit of money to use prints. So there's, I don't know if that answers your question, Brian. Hopefully it gives you some
ideas. Thank you.
And I just wanted to ask a quick follow-up, and I've kind of asked this again, but just to come back, with all the work and support you're putting into Pressbooks, do you ever see expanding the access to it for projects that are sort of outside of the scope of the Open Textbook Project?
Yes. Yeah. Mary and I have talked about this over the summer, and we would like to, once we get a stable platform that is working. I mean, we just, over the summer, one of the things we did is we got our own version of it up and running. So once we get the platform stabilized, I can see us opening it up. Maybe not with like the traditional BC Campus shared services model, but in some ways for other projects. Yeah, that's certainly something we've talked about and I can see happening.
Great.
So we're nearly out of time, and I just would like to invite everyone on the chat. You know, we got about, just from my quick scan, at least 6 or 7 different schools with at least one person here. Does anybody want to share a project they're working on, something interesting they're looking at, something they've read, anything they'd like to share with the group before we sign off?
I'd like to just make a quick plug really quick, not for a project I'm involved in at all, but an instructor here at UBC is launching what they're calling an open online experience. So it's at OOE13.org, and I'll throw it out there. And this is seen as something very similar to EdMOOC. Christina Hendricks is the person at UBC who's worked on it, but I think there's something like 40 other people behind the scenes also doing some stuff on it. And it's seen as a professional development experience for ed tech people. So it looks like a pretty cool setup, and it's launching, I believe, next week.
I worked with Christina quite a bit when I was at UBC, and it was interesting watching the EdMOOC experience. It really seemed to have energized her interest in kind of open and online processes and stuff like that, and she's just become a force in the last 6 months, and she was out here in Kamloops last week, and she just made an outstanding contribution to our podcast. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. Anyone else have anything they'd like to point out or plug? I'm hearing a bit of quiet. So what I'm going to do is also just point out two updates on my end. One was the podcasting workshop I was just referring to was called Sound Camp. And this kind of came out of the DS106 universe. There's a fellow there who had been doing some really outstanding audio work. It goes by the name of Scott Lowe. But because he'd been based in Japan and then more recently Saudi Arabia, pretty well nobody had actually ever met him in person. And in fact, some people disputed whether he in fact existed as a unique human entity. So when I heard that he was going to be visiting the state of Oregon briefly, that was the kind of catalyst to bring him to Kamloops for a day of hands-on audio work. And Christina joined us, as I mentioned, and Jason, who's on this call, came out. And Andrew Forgrave, who is also a DS106er, came out all the way from Ontario on his own dime. And I can't thank all those people enough. They were all just incredible facilitators. We had about 20 people doing hands-on audio work all day long. I really want to thank Clint, you know, talking about the idea of, sharing process and why it's a good thing to do. I wrote a quick blog post just kind of talking about some of my concerns of going into the workshop about whether it would be structured appropriately. And Clint, that old radio hand, jumped in with this incredibly detailed and rich comment, all sorts of wonderful resources in it. Thank you again for that. I posted the content there, and I actually hope that the site, besides just being documenting that workshop, is going to be something of an ongoing audio tutorial and resource that'll continue to evolve and could be used for future workshops, not only here but elsewhere. And obviously, it's all Creative Commons licensed, and hopefully, other people will take materials from it if they find it useful. And if they have suggestions on how to make it better, please pass those on. And I guess the final thing I will mention, And we might want to do a full-on chat on this in the future. As at the last ETUG meeting, one of the themes of the session Will and I co-facilitated was kind of the struggles for individual institutions to support open collaborative technologies. And not only in terms of hosting, but you know, in terms of things like design and expertise. And when, you know, to bring this full circle to how we started the session, you know, the ability to, you know, what Alan brought to the RMOOC is something that, you know, if we had to depend on kind of our existing capacity, we just couldn't have done it. So it's not, unfortunately, really scalable to just ask Alan to work individually on all our courses, although I understand that Alan is certainly ready to work if people have interesting projects, and I certainly couldn't recommend them highly enough. But anyway, so along those lines, I've been talking to as many people as I can about this. And actually, I'm really glad to see a couple of the people on this call. Tanis in particular has had some really lucid and interesting thoughts on how to structure this. So among other things, I took part in a BCNet call. Mary Burgess was part of that call as well. And essentially, for my sins, I've been tasked to lead a working group on collaborative technologies to support open education. And my first action item that I'm committed to doing is issuing a call for participation. So I think many of the people on this call, you can expect me to follow up with you. What I'm hoping to do is gather a group of people from different institutions and interest groups around the province. And first of all, just find out who is interested in some sort of collaborative approach to hosting and, more importantly, supporting and designing environments in open tools. And really hoping we can take it from there. So I just want to put that out there, that this call will be kind of coming forward, and I'll be putting it out in as many fora as I can imagine. And I really, really hope at least some of you will be able to join. As I'm really pleased to see so many of the people that I really count on for expertise in this area. And I think that's all the blabbing I'm here to do. Anyone else?
Well, I just wanted to thank everyone for speaking today and being part of this call. And, you know, I think this was exactly what we were trying to hope we hoped we would accomplish by just having interesting talks and some good conversation happening. One thing that I just want to bring up is that we hope that these will continue on sort of a monthly basis. And we've sort of set up that site on the UBC Wiki, but it links through to a Google document, and we can sort of set up the agenda for the next one and try to get a date. Another hope for this is that we'll experiment with different technologies. So this time we use Big Blue Button, which Frank set up for us, and we really appreciate that, and looking at other technologies. So if anybody wants to take over for hosting next month or the following month, please let us know.
Although this works so well, I suspect we might ask Frank to do it again. Thank you again.
I've been impressed.
This worked really painlessly. And along those lines, I mean, we're going to do this at least once a month, and we're going to treat it essentially as open meetings. So as many or as few people join, we're going to do them at least once a month, and we'll post some sort of archive in podcast format as well. And also, you know, we'll do it at least once a month, but if there's significant interest and things to talk about, we could do it every 2 weeks if people want to do it then, whatever works. And along those lines, if anyone's interested in joining and discussing a specific topic or a project they're working on, we would love to do it with you. So with that, I will say goodbye. Thank you, Will. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks all. Ciao, ciao for now.
Okay, bye-bye.
You are currently the only person in this conference.